welcome to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about how the immune system affects fertility and miscarriage and what you can do about it. This is both an interesting as well as a controversial topic, and I think you're really going to enjoy this. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
Natural killer cells are a cell type, but despite their name, they're not necessarily bad or evil. And in fact, there have been a number of studies showing that women who have high levels of natural killer cells in their uterus have a lower rate of pregnancy loss.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport, and I am your host and the director of Creating a Family. And you can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. For women who have been undergoing fertility treatment and are still struggling to conceive, Ferring wants you to know about an app called Ferticalm. And that's F-E-R-T-I-Calm, C-A-L-M. It was designed specifically to help women address the many challenging emotional life situations that arrive when they are wanting to be pregnant and are not. It was designed specifically to give you practical solutions of what you can do to cope with the stress of infertility. You can get more information at Ferticalm app. .com. That's F-E-R-T-I-C-A-L-M-A-P-P, FerticalmApp.com. And we thank them for their support. Today we're going to be talking about our immune system and how it impacts fertility and miscarriage, and what reproductive endocrinologists and infertility nurses can do about that. We'll be talking with Dr. Zev Williams. He is an MD and a PhD and is the chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility and an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Columbia University Medical Center. And he is a nationally recognized clinician and researcher in the area of recurrent pregnancy loss and infertility. He practices at Columbia University Fertility Center. Welcome, Dr. Williams. Thank you so much for talking with us today about this fairly controversial and in some ways misunderstood aspect of fertility. We're thankful to have you.
Well, thank you, Don. And it is a very controversial and complex area, so I'm more than happy to discuss and see how we can help clarify some points.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's start. I feel like so often I say this, but let's start at the beginning. I think it would be helpful to give us just a bird's eye view of how the human immune system works and specifically how it interplays with pregnancy, conception, actually, more than pregnancy.
Sure, and I should tell your listeners that this is an area where we're still learning more and more every day. And so the picture about how the immune system works and how tolerance to pregnancy works is an area of very active research. And truthfully, it's one of those areas where it becomes more and more fascinating the more deeply we are able to delve into it.
Yeah, I
so
totally
in general,
agree. I really do. Yeah.
You know, we have this really interesting challenge where the immune system has developed this incredibly elegant ability to monitor, to look for when there's a foreign invader or even a cancer type of cell, and to say this is something that's not supposed to be there and to try to then seek it out and destroy it, while at the same time seeing our own cells and saying, hey, this is normal and this is supposed to be there, and leaving those cells alone. And that's not an easy task to do. It's sort of been this ongoing battle through the millennia of evolution where bacteria and foreign organisms are getting more and more sophisticated, and our immune system is constantly learning and adapting to be able to detect and destroy them. Now, one area where these two challenges come into sort of a point of confrontation is in the point of pregnancy, where you have a pregnancy, which when you think about it, even in case of a donor egg, might be something that's completely foreign, right? The contribution from the mother could be a donor egg. And certainly in every other pregnancy, the sperm is from another individual. Yet the mother's immune system has to recognize this as being something that's not to be destroyed. And the pregnancy itself has to be able to signal and moderate and enable itself to survive in a mother with a relatively intact immune system. The reason I say relatively is we do know that in pregnancy, it's a state of suppressed, a mild and moderated immunosuppression, which is why women are at higher risk for things like the flu when they're pregnant and those infections are worse. But in general, you can think of it sort of as this challenge where you've got a pregnancy that's developing and the mother's immune system having to tolerate it and recognize that this is something not to be destroyed.
Yeah, and that is a fine balance. There are two basic types of immunological responses that are involved with, or we think are involved with, infertility. One is the autoimmune, and the other one is the alloimmune. Let's start with autoimmune. Can you talk to us about what are the autoimmune disorders that are, and I think autoimmune, let me just say, is probably the most is the most common of those two. So how is the autoimmune system dysfunction involved with female infertility?
Yeah, so I think that's very good. And one of the things I should sort of preface my comments with is that there's certain areas when we speak about the immune system in pregnancy where there is widespread consensus and agreement, and others where there is very little evidence and a lot of controversy. So where there is widespread...
Okay, point that out as we go. Yes, great.
Right.
Okay.
So where there is widespread consensus is that the immune system plays a absolutely critical and complex role in allowing pregnancy to progress. And that this, it's also assumed that any dysfunctions in that can result in pregnancy loss. Where it becomes controversial is in some of the cases where sort of the well-established autoimmune causes of pregnancy loss are not present. And so there's sort of speculation that, oh, there must be some other sort of forms where the mother's immune system is rejecting the pregnancy, and then certain much more controversial things like IVIG and intralipid and steroids are used, even when in many cases there are studies showing that they're not any better than placebo. Mm-hmm. So what you touched on first, some of the autoimmune causes. So there's a few and quite well-defined ones which clearly play a role in pregnancy loss. So for example, there's a condition called antiphospholipid syndrome. That's when the body makes antibodies against sort of the membranes of cells. Women who have this condition make certain types of antibodies and are at higher risk of pregnancy loss. And this is a critical part, there's treatment that helps reduce that risk. So things like baby aspirin and injectable blood thinners are used to help reduce the risk of pregnancy loss, specifically in women who have antiphospholipid syndrome. Another example is in women who have antithyroid peroxidase, or TPO, antibodies. Those are antibodies that attack the thyroid. Those women, it appears, have higher rates of pregnancy loss. And so they've been sort of, and that's one of the more better established. There's still some controversy in that area, but some studies, you know, clearly pointing a link between those as well. So those are conditions where the body's immune system is targeting cells or parts of cells or proteins, making antibodies against them. And in women who have those, they also appear to have higher rates of pregnancy loss. And in some cases, there's interventions that help reduce that risk.
Are there interventions for the antithyroid antibodies or women who have higher or elevated levels of antithyroid? You've mentioned for the antiphospholipids that baby aspirin and I guess heparin or an injectable thinner are have been shown to be effective, but what about for antithyroid antibodies?
It's a very good question. I'll tell you, there isn't like a well-established one where you say, okay, someone has antithyroid peroxidase antibodies, this is what we should do. What we've started to do is in some cases where the antibody levels can be extremely high, you know, normally you'll have a level, let's say that's less than 5, and we'll have a patient who's over 1,000. So this is not like a borderline number. We sort of step back and say, well, why are they making these antibodies in the first place? And one thing that was known is that the proteins in the thyroid that help make the thyroid hormone have an element in their core called selenium. Selenium is a nutrient that comes from the soil. It's present in a lot of foods. It's actually very enriched in Brazil nuts. If any of your listeners are ever on a trivia game show and they ask that, it's the Brazil nut that's very enriched in selenium. But what's interesting is it's been shown that populations that have low levels of selenium have higher rates of these antithyroid peroxidase antibodies. And it was also shown that when women who have these antibodies have higher rates of a condition called postpartum thyroiditis, so that after delivery, they have a flare in their antibodies, and that can cause certain complications after delivery. But what was interesting was that they found if they gave selenium in the third trimester of pregnancy, they reduced the rates of postpartum thyroiditis in half. That's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
So we sort of speculated, well, maybe the issue is that the body is, some women might have not enough selenium total in their body, and so the thyroid antibody, the thyroid proteins don't have enough inside of them, so they're getting misformed. So perhaps if the women took more selenium, they could replenish the selenium, help restore the shape of the proteins, and reduce the selenium, the anti-thyroid antibodies. And indeed, for a number of these patients, when they took selenium, they saw dramatic reductions in their thyroid peroxidase antibodies. But this didn't occur to all patients, so it's an area where we're still investigating.
But, all right, so is there, if someone has unexplained infertility or IVF failure that where they have gone
mm-hmm.
through, why would they not want to just start eating some Brazil nuts? I don't know if the quantity would be high enough that you would get enough selenium to make it even worth your while. But if it's effective at the third trimester, would it not, in just logically thinking, would it not make sense to try to increase selenium before IVF or before even trying natural conception?
It would, and that's something that we do. So the Brazil nuts are the natural way. You can also just buy them in any health food or drug store. You can buy a pill of it. You know, it's like 25 cents a pill. It's not an expensive medication.
Yeah.
And so that is one thing, you know, where we discuss. This is still an area where there have not been rigorous clinical trials showing that it's effective. It does make sense. It's essentially, you know, it's about as low risk as anything can get. And if it works, it's dramatic. So I don't think it's unreasonable.
For the anti-thyroid one.
Correct.
And
only for some women. It's only effective if the reason that they're making the thyroid antibodies is because they don't have enough selenium.
Are there
in which
things
case,
that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Case replenishing the selenium will help correct the proteins, which would, in theory, bring down the antibodies. But again, this is an area that's still undergoing research.
So for women, what are the risk factors that women might want to think about either after they've had a failure of IVF or infertility treatment or mm-hmm. even before? Let's go to the antiphospholipid antibody. So what would be the symptoms of somebody who has high antibodies, high antiphospholipid antibodies?
Well, there's sort of two parts to the testing. Part is clinical and part is laboratory. The laboratory-based is a simple blood test that measures these antibodies. And the reality is that it's such a well-established cause of pregnancy loss that for women who have had recurrent pregnancy loss, that's essentially two or more, they will have that testing done.
Okay.
There aren't sort of, other than sort of a history of, you know, certain types of pregnancy complications, there aren't sort of certain physical stigmata that you would find associated with this condition. It's sort of an acquired thrombophilia, and the way to test it is primarily with these blood tests. But for someone who has recurrent pregnancy loss, it should be one of the first-line tests that's done.
Okay, so your risk factor is having lost two or more pregnancies. That would be indicative of potential, and then you'd want to test for it. So what about the anti-thyroid antibodies? It would seem like you would... that women who had developed those antibodies would have a weakened thyroid, or at least do they more often have symptoms of maybe subclinical thyroid issues or not?
They can, and one of the things you'll find is, so if the antibodies are blocking the ability of the thyroid to see the thyroid hormone, stimulating hormone, and their thyroid hormone levels are low, they'll feel the signs of symptoms of hypothyroidism. So they'll have things like low energy, their skin might appear dry, hair is brittle, and conversely, if these antibodies are activating the thyroid, they'll have super high levels of energy. They could have sort of their bulging. You can sometimes see bulging of the eyes, heart racing. With low levels, you could sort of feel cold when everyone else is warm, and with high levels, you feel warm when everyone else is cold. The nice thing about this test as well, though, and when you do an exam, sometimes you'll feel an enlarged thyroid. What's nice about this as well is this is not something you have to guess about. There is a blood test that will, and this is absolutely something that should be done for anyone who has either infertility or pregnancy loss to measure thyroid hormone levels.
Okay. All right. So the risk factors, again, would be unexplained failure. And is it primarily, do we look at this primarily as an implantation failure issue, or do we know at what point it is that these autoimmune issues are affecting the pregnancy or the efficacy of IVF?
Well, it's an interesting question. So it seems like the current thinking is that the immune system dysfunction would be acting once the pregnancy has been established. Before implantation, there's not really something there for the immune system to react to. What's mm-hmm. become quite fascinating is there was a really interesting paper that was published in Cell, which is one of our leading journals, a few years ago, where they noticed that there's a special type of cell called a peripheral T regulatory cell that exists in every animal in the entire animal kingdom that has a placenta. But anything that lays an egg doesn't have it. And it's interesting because once you have a placenta, your immune system has to be able to tolerate that pregnancy. When you're laying an egg, you don't have that issue to worry about. And when they made mice that didn't have this special cell, the peripheral T regulatory cell, and these mice appeared completely healthy and normal, except they had higher pregnancy loss rates, miscarriage rates. So they fertilized normally, and they had the same number of implantations happening, but they would start to have these cells being reabsorbed. And it looked like the role of this special cell, the peripheral T regulatory cell, was to induce tolerance, which is kind of counter to the prior 5 decades worth of thinking on the subject. You know, in the past, people had speculated, well, maybe some women are having recurrent pregnancy loss because their immune system is overly active and it's rejecting the fetus. And so that's why people tried things like IVIG and intralipid and steroids to try and suppress them. And that thinking is pretty intuitive. It makes sense, right? Like if I took a piece of skin from one person to another, that second person's immune system would reject the skin transplant. If you transplant a kidney from one person to another, the immune system will reject the kidney. And here we're talking about an entire baby with, you know, all the organs developing inside a mother. So it's understandable that you would have this notion, oh, maybe the mother's immune system is rejecting the fetus. It also fits into some of the mistaken sort of thinking people had about pregnancy loss with the rejection of the pregnancy. But all these treatments, again, were shown not to be more beneficial than placebo. Again, that doesn't mean women don't have success after many losses when they do these treatments. It's just they have success at the same rates as if they had used placebo. So with the loss of this cell, though, it sort of points us in a totally different direction, which is that the tolerance to pregnancy is an active process. It's not the absence of rejection. It's a process of actually inducing tolerance to the pregnancy. And so one of the immune treatments that's actually been shown to be better than placebo in a randomized trial was giving a medication that causes the immune system to become more active, not suppressed.
That is counterintuitive.
Yeah.
So how can a underactive immune system, why would that be threatening to a pregnancy?
Well, I think a good way to think about it is if you think about the conditions we know of in medicine where there's an overactive immune system, those are typically not associated with pregnancy loss. So things like asthma, eczema, psoriasis, those conditions where you have, you know, there's some people who have all these allergies, they don't have higher rates of recurrent pregnancy loss than the general population, but they have a ramped up overly active immune system. And it's probably more subtle than what we're thinking about. It's not some global phenomenon, but something more targeted to the actual tolerance to the pregnancy that's at play. To give you just an inkling about how complex this is, last month we published the first detailed atlas of the single cell atlas of the human placenta from the first trimester, looking at the cell types that are there.
Oh, wow.
And it's absolutely mind-boggling how complex it is and how much interaction there is going on between the mother's decidua, that's the lining of the uterus during pregnancy, and the placenta. There's this constant backtalk and cross-communication between the two. And so when you see that and you really see the complexity and the intricacy of these interactions, you realize how something that critical could go wrong. And there could be problems in that. But something as sort of broad of a view of just, okay, well, let's knock out the immune system with steroids, probably isn't really addressing the right issue.
Yeah, and it goes to show we're still not sure exactly what the issue is.
Right.
Yeah. Although
that's very true.
It makes logical sense to think that the immune system may have something to do with it. But the report in Cell, the journal Cell, the study in Cell would indicate that it's just the opposite of what I would say common sense, but I don't think that's true. I think it's my lack of fully understanding the immune system that would think of that.
Well, and I wouldn't say it's just yours. I think the whole process is one of those areas where the more we study it, the more fascinating it gets. I mean, the reality is for a pregnancy to succeed, so many things have to go right. And a big part of research now is just trying to understand what those things are that have to go right.
Yeah.
So that we can start to see where there may be cases where there's a problem.
So some of the places where it can go wrong would be the implantation itself, where the embryo is implanting, although you're saying that right now the current research may be indicating that that's less of a problematic point, but it's as the embryo and the fetus placenta is developing to support the embryo and the fetus. Is there a particular time in the pregnancy that if it's going to be a problem, it would be a problem? So we could say, well, miscarriages that happen at this stage might be more likely to be caused by an immune system malfunction.
Yeah, I have to say I really love your questions. You know, the bulk of our practice are patients who've had, or a lot of our patients who've had really challenging cases of unexplained infertility, recurrent implantation failure, miscarriage, and really trying to delve in to find answers and solutions. The implantation area is recurrent implantation failure has always been a particularly challenging area because unlike the case of pregnancy loss, you don't have any tissue to be able to any pregnancy tissue to test. And we know, for example, most cases of pregnancy loss are due to genetic factors, which we can now test for. You know, there's newer technologies that we're developing that get us even better insights, but that's certainly a cause. With implantation failures, you by definition don't have a pregnancy that's developed. There, it seems like it might be, at least in some cases, more due to a shift in when the lining of the uterus is able to allow implantation to happen. So I think most people, including physicians, if you sort of said, what's the role of the uterus, they would say, oh, well, that's where the pregnancy implants. The truth is a pregnancy, an embryo, will implant pretty much anywhere you put it. If you put it on the ovary, it'll implant on the ovary. If you put it on bowel, it can attach to bowel. Ectopic pregnancies are caused by an embryo implanting in a fallopian tube. In fact, the only place in the body where an embryo won't implant most of the time is the uterus. If you put in an embryo into the uterus for most of the menstrual cycle, most of the time of the menstrual cycle, let's say a 28-day cycle, for the vast, vast majority of that cycle, the embryo will not implant. And that's, in some ways, one of the critical roles of the uterus, is to prevent an embryo from implanting when it's arriving at the wrong time, because that would suggest it's not a healthy embryo. There is this little window that opens, what we call the implantation window, which is when the uterus now allows implantation to happen. And so in some women, it might be that their implantation window is shifted. Either it's a day earlier or a day later, so that if they're trying to conceive on their own, they don't get pregnant because the embryo is showing up when it's supposed to, but their implantation window isn't open. And if they're doing IVF the traditional ways, it won't work either because the embryos are being put back into the uterus at the wrong time. So that's one of those really interesting areas where it might not be the immune system that's playing a role. It might just be in terms of the synchrony between the embryo and the lining.
Yeah, and that's another area of ripe for research.
Correct.
Yeah, exactly. Is some of this research into immunology being aided by the fact that so many embryos now are being genetically tested so we can rule out aneuploidy, which is what the vast majority of miscarriages are caused by chromosomal issues. And so now we can rule, not always, but if there's genetic testing, we can rule that out. So we know we have a euploid, you know, high-grade embryo, and if it doesn't implant, or if it does implant and then doesn't grow, then we look elsewhere. Is that why we're reaching this point where the study of immunology is such a ripe one right now?
Yeah, I think you're definitely onto a really important point. You know, in the past, you'd have a woman where you see she's ovulating every month, her tubes are fine, and a man who has a normal semen analysis who keeps not getting pregnant. Maybe they go through IVF, and they make a bunch of embryos, and you keep transferring the embryos, but the woman doesn't get pregnant. And it was always assumed, well, these embryos, you know, maybe this is because the embryos kept being chromosomally abnormal, so aneuploid, having an extra chromosome or a missing chromosome or multiple extra or missing chromosomes. And it was sort of assumed, well, that's probably explaining it. The technology you alluded to, PGS, preimplantation genetic screening, involves taking an embryo that's about 5 days old, taking off, doing a little biopsy of the embryo to sample some of the cells from the outside of the embryo, what will eventually become the placenta, and testing those cells to see if the embryo was chromosomally normal or not, and then only transferring back into the uterus a chromosomally normal embryo. But then what we found was even when we did that, that did explain, you know, that you might have some women who make 8 embryos and all 8 are chromosomally abnormal. So in the past, we would have transferred one after another and she would not have gotten pregnant, and that would have been recurrent implantation failure when, in fact, it was an unhealthy embryo. Mm-hmm. Now, though, we're seeing, wow, these are chromosomally normal embryos, but there's some patients who, despite putting in chromosomally normal embryos, aren't getting pregnant, and that's where we're able to now sort of fine-tune our focus into those patients for whom there really is a problem with implantation and not with the embryo. Mm-hmm. The role of the immune system has been, you know, this is, people have speculated about the role of the immune system for decades, but we're getting more and more advanced tools that allow us to sort of profile how the immune system is functioning. But we're still really not there yet. So there are certainly labs where you can order a blood test and they'll measure dozens of different cytokines and cell types and ratios between cell types. But most of the professional organizations, including ASRM and ACOG, as well as their Canadian European counterparts, recommend against the testing because they haven't shown that the abnormalities that are found are any different in women who have recurrent pregnancy losses compared to those who go on to have normal pregnancies. So it's absolutely true that if you have a woman who's had recurrent pregnancy loss, you'll often find elevated levels of certain cytokines. The real question that have to be asked is, well, is that different from the rate at which you'll find it in the general population? And are these elevated cytokines reflecting the fact that she might have just recently been pregnant or have had a number of DNCs and losses versus actually being the cause of the problem? The other thing that complicates matters is that for many women, you know, and this is good news, there's a very high rate of success after, you know, relatively small numbers of pregnancy loss, even with no intervention. So, for example, there was a large, well-designed study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, taking women who had more than 3 pregnancy losses and randomizing them to either getting progesterone or placebo. So these women, the group that got progesterone, had a 64% live birth rate, which means if you had 100 women that had 3 or more losses and you gave them the progesterone, 64 would go on to have a live birth. That's a great number, and these 64 mm-hmm. women would be saying, wow, this progesterone is exactly what it needed, what I needed mm-hmm. to be helped. But then you look at the placebo group, which also had a roughly 64% live birth rate. So in that group, that was a, you know, they would have been saying the same thing. And so for a lot of the interventions, if they're as good as placebo, but even if they're worse than placebo, if an intervention is worse than placebo, you can still have a lot of women who've had multiple losses take that intervention and would naturally conclude that that intervention helped, even if the chance that they had a loss would have been higher with that intervention. So it becomes a very, very challenging area in research because you need to be able to do well-designed, randomized controlled trials to be able to make meaningful conclusions from the research.
And there was a meta-analysis that I think was published in 2014 by Dr. Wong, and they looked at, and there may be something more recent than that, but it looked at 20, I think high quality, I think it was 20 trials, including a fair number of women, well over 1,000, assessing the different types of immune therapies, and did not find that there was no increase in live birth rate. There may be some more current. Is there something more current than that has looked at the various types of treatments? And I assume this is not for the antiphospholipids or the antithyroid, but
correct.
For, yeah. Is there something
correct.
More current or is that the, yeah?
Yeah, no. There have been, the paper that you had mentioned was a Cochrane Library. So they do very well-designed sort of systematic reviews of the literature, looking sort of at the role of immunotherapy for recurrent miscarriage, and did not identify any of the agents as actually being effective for prevention, which is true. They did not include what we talked about at the beginning, sort of antiphospholipid syndrome in those cases, because mm-hmm. those have already been very well studied and shown to have an effect. So understandably, they left those ones out, and we're looking at more of the controversial area that you and I were talking about. They also didn't include the Neupogen trials that we talked about, so that was not in this. And that study has not also been replicated yet.
And when you speak of when you were speaking of cytokines, I think that a lot of people have hear the term that they are more familiar with, but I believe it's connected, is activated natural killer cells. And with a name like activated natural killer cells, it certainly grabs your attention. And so, whereas cytokines really is a little more mundane. How does activated natural killer cells play into all of this?
I thank you for helping me remember to clarify that. So cytokines
well,
are sort of
I'm not a doctor, so I go for things like natural killer cells. I mean, that's nightmare-inducing, okay?
It was quite a naming job that they did on that cell type.
I love it myself.
Right. And what's interesting, actually, so by the name, it even sounds evil.
It does.
So cytokines are these sort of factors that are secreted in the blood. Natural killer cells are a cell type, but despite their name, they're not necessarily bad or evil. And in fact, there have been a number of studies showing that women who have high levels of natural killer cells in their uterus have a lower rate of pregnancy loss. That sort of feeds into what we were talking about before, about how the immune cells are not necessarily this evil cell that you have to sort of get rid of and suppress, that they may actually be playing a very important role in terms of allowing the pregnancy to be established and training it to be accepted by the mother's overall immune system. And it really is this interplay. When you think about, you know, the pregnancy is a time where you need to have a group of cells attach, invade into the mother, but not invade too much, right? You don't want the placenta growing into the uterus and accreta. Those are other sort of problems that can happen. And so you need this sort of balance of tolerance, but still preventing it from growing too far. And so these natural killer cells, again, despite their name, in within the uterus appear not to be a bad thing, and higher levels may actually be associated with lower rates of pregnancy loss.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It feels counterintuitive, but it goes back to what you were saying before about that balance where we need to, we need some of our, we want our immune system to be fairly active to sustain a healthy pregnancy.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking with Dr. Zev Williams. He is an MD, PhD when he is practicing with Columbia University Fertility Center, and he is a researcher in the field of recurrent pregnancy loss as well as infertility. This show, as well as all the resources we provide at Creating a Family, could not and would not happen without the support of our partners. And these are clinics who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patients And one such partner is Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. They are a full-service fertility center specializing in IVF, egg donation, egg and embryo freezing, and LGBTQ family-building issues, reproductive surgeries, and male reproductive medicine. They provide highly individualized patient care offered through 13 reproductive endocrinologists and fertility specialists and a urologist, as well as a fully staffed support team. And we thank them for their support. All right, so we've talked about some of the autoimmune. I said there was another one, and that would be the alloimmune disorders. And so what do we mean by alloimmune disorders?
So it is a confusing terminology. So alloimmune also is referred to as isoimmune. That's where there's an immune response to self. The challenge with immunity is to be able to see with the immune cell when you're having something that's self versus non-self. And the alloimmunes are things, for example, that you would have for something that's transferred. So an example would be like a blood transfusion. So in that case, it's something that's foreign. Your body sees, oh, this isn't my own cells, and I will try to reject it.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. Okay. So how does that play into infertility?
Well, that's where it's not clear that it does. Where there are certain absolute types of pregnancy complications where, for example, the blood cells of the fetus will express an antigen that's foreign, and the mother's immune cell would attack that. So the common example of that is with the Rh factor. So when women are pregnant, they're given a medication called Rogam. It actually first developed at Columbia. And that helps prevent the mother's immune system from attacking that antigen that could be on the fetal blood cells. So that's an example of alloimmunity, where the body is making an immune response to something that's not self.
So we sometimes hear, albeit mainly from patients, but about where the female's body is reacting to the sperm. And we sometimes hear a woman will say, I'm allergic to my husband's sperm or my partner's sperm. Is that a form of alloimmune reaction? And does that really happen?
Right. So I think your second question is the primary question. Women can make an immune response, for example, if they're using lubricant, if they're using condoms, latex. Women can make immune responses to that. To actually make an immune response against the sperm does not seem, and there is this testing for sperm antibodies and determining whether the antibodies are attacking the head or the tail of the sperm. That does not seem to be a major cause of infertility and certainly not a pregnancy loss. Where we do see things with pregnancy loss are, again, where there's certain factors that are expressed by the cells of the fetus that the mother would not have. So, for example, I mentioned the Rh factor, KEL, there's a few of these factors. What we do in those circumstances is in the past, if a woman's had a pregnancy, for example, she's Rh negative, her partner is Rh positive, the fetus is Rh positive, and she's making antibodies against it, the baby could develop an anemia while it's still inside the mother, inside the uterus, and could even need transfusions. One way around that now is we would do PGD. So they would do IVF, we'd do PGD, and we'd only put back embryos that are Rh negative so that there is no risk that the mother develops that sort of an alloimmune reaction.
Oh, why wouldn't Rogam be more effective than that? Am I misunderstanding where that would be used?
No, it absolutely would be more effective, but if it wasn't used and the mother still developed it.
Gotcha.
So Rogam
works
against the Rh factor, but in some cases it wasn't given and the mother developed an immunity to the Rh factor, or it's to any one of many, many other factors that are in the blood that they don't have the sort of Rogam equivalent for.
Gotcha. Okay, so that makes sense. We know there are other factors such as Rh that could influence it, but we don't have either test for nor treatment for.
Correct. And so what they'll end up needing, you know, we had, for example, a patient who had the same thing with Kel. So in the past, she's needed multiple transfusions. It's very high risk for the pregnancy, but we're able to just select embryos that don't express Kel, and then it's no different from any other pregnancy.
A normal pregnancy.
Okay, low-risk pregnancy.
So I've also read about where the father's HLA marker is too close to the mom's HLA, and that impacts implantation and or miscarriage. So tell us what HLA is, and is there scientific evidence to support that?
Yeah, so HLA, our cells need ways of identifying themselves as being self, in addition to being non-self, right? So it's sort of, you could think of it as, you need to say, the immune system needs to recognize both that something is foreign and that it's self. So foreign isn't the absence of self, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You need two positive signals. One, that's something that's foreign, but if there's not a signal that something is foreign, you need to signal that something that's self. Because otherwise, the foreign agents could just sort of hide the foreign parts to them. They also have to be able to show that they're self. And that's where sort of a lot of this sort of MHC and HLA comes in, which is in terms of allowing the cells to sort of self-identify themselves. The HLA part and the story in pregnancy loss is also a very, very controversial one, where, again, most of the professional organizations have reviewed it and said that the treatment and the screening for it is not warranted. And in fact, if you look at a lot of sort of groups that intermarry, and so have very little diversity, you don't see really high rates of infertility or miscarriage among them.
You took the.
So there
I was going to ask that exact question. So we know that there are definitely, there are island populations. There's also certain ethnic groups where there's a great deal of there's not a lot of diversity in the gene pool. And so, you would assume then that these markers, and HLA being one of them, would be of the male partner would be more similar than a diverse partner to the moms. And
right.
So populations, we're not seeing a higher rate of infertility, IVF failure, or miscarriage.
Correct. And so if you look at things like sort of what we call mucosal CD16, embryotoxic factor, cytokine profiling, HLA typing, antipaternal leukocyte antibodies, these are some of the tests that are available. The professional organizations don't recommend doing any of those.
And they don't recommend it because of the efficacy. They haven't been shown to be effective, and the cost. Or is it a two-factor? Is it because it is harmful to treat for it, or simply ineffective to treat for it?
Well, so I wouldn't say the cost would be, you know, if these were effective, then the whatever the cost would be, if there's anything reasonable, would be worth it, right? If a woman's having recurrent pregnancy loss, there's not really a blood test. If that was really showing what the cause of was and you can fix it, that they would say, oh, that's not cost-effective to do.
Sure, yeah.
The problem is that the testing hasn't been shown to be predictive. So you will take women who've had high rates of pregnancy loss and measure the numbers, but when they go back to compare them against women like control groups, you're not seeing the sort of differences that you would expect, A, and B, if you do find those differences, it's hard to say what to do about it. I think one area where the testing is more promising is sort of looking at more refined levels of analysis of sperm, for example. So in the past, we've sort of looked at the shape, the concentration, how well they swim. That's sort of been the gist of our analysis of sperm. But now we're sort of, you know, and there was a paper that just came out last month sort of showing that even within sperm, you can look at the fragmentation of the DNA inside of it, and women who have high rates of pregnancy loss, their partners appear to have higher rates of fragmentation of the DNA inside the sperm. So they're able to get pregnant, but the pregnancy is severely genetically compromised, even if it's not sort of the chromosomal problem that we talked at the beginning about having an extra missing chromosome.
Interesting. Okay. So, yeah, you're right. From again, as we start delving further, we will start looking at things that in the past, We just attributed the problems to genetic abnormalities in the embryo, and now when we have to, now that we disprove that, we have to look closer. And I guess sperm would be obviously one that we would want to, considering it's providing half the DNA.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And I think in the past we sort of assumed, well, the sperm was able to fertilize the egg; it did what it needed to. But what's interesting is the first 5 days of an embryo's life, it's not using that really the paternal genes. Those only get turned on later in the embryo's life. And so it might be that the sperm is able to fertilize the embryo, it could start to develop, but once it starts to need some of those paternal genes, if there's DNA damage that's there, that could be a problem. But
mm-hmm.
for right now, I mean, to get back to your original question, testing for things like HLA and embryotoxic factors, the recommendation is not to, because the results have not been able to really be reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so it's not a question of the cost. If you could reproduce it and it's shown to be effective in preventing it, we would be 100% on board with it. It's just
mm-hmm.
you also don't want to put someone down a pathway that's not the one that's actually causing the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so these red herrings could be an issue.
So for a woman who has had, let's take unexplained IVF failure. And then I'm also going to ask the same question for recurrent miscarriage or recurrent pregnancy loss. So for a woman who has had IVF failure, and I guess to make this a relevant question, we would have to assume that that the embryos have been tested and have been shown to be chromosomally normal. So what is the standard of treatment for, first of all, how many failures do you have before it becomes at that point it becomes considered a problem, and what would be the standard of treatment for women with IVF failure?
I think I like how you sort of grouped the recurrent IVF failure and the recurrent pregnancy loss failure together, because in some ways they're very similar in the sense that you sort of you need to look very systematically at all the steps that have to go right to first see if you could identify where there's a problem. And very often, basic things can be missed. So, for example, making sure that the cavity of the uterus is normal, that there's not a polyp or scarring or something abnormal that might be preventing the embryo from implanting. The other thing, especially when it comes to IVF, is to make sure that the lab that you're using is a really, really top-notch lab. And we've spent years sort of refining and developing and improving the quality of the lab, because you want the embryo not just to be a day five embryo, but to be a healthiest possible one to give the best possible chance of implanting. And along those lines, there also, I think, needs to be some flexibility. There's some women who keep failing, for example, day five embryos, but if you go a little bit earlier and transfer to day three, they have success. So the ability to really tailor the care to what the patient's individual needs are is paramount.
Okay, that's interesting. By the changing from five to going back to five to three, it almost that's a why would that be effective? That's certainly not the movement we're seeing. In fact, we're moving ever more towards five, and a lot of talk now about six day failed embryos. So why would the transfer of a 3 day old embryo be considered, and that would preclude, I would assume, embryonic
genetic testing.
Yeah. So why would that be potentially for somebody who has failed? Is it more the theory of, well, if 5 day hadn't worked, we should try 3 day because it hasn't worked the other way? Is that
I think the idea is, so day five embryos are more likely to implant. It's not because you've grown them to day five that they're more likely to implant. It's by virtue of the fact that they've survived to day five, they've got be a pretty hardy embryo. An embryo that would have never made it to day five is obviously going to have a lower chance.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing, if you find someone who's 100 years old, they're much more likely to make it to 101 than someone who's 20. But when you found that person when they were 20, it's not like they were less likely to make it to 101. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah.
So with the embryos, it seems like the same thing. It's true that for the vast majority of patients, say over 90% of our patients, the transfer would be on day five. But you will find those patients for whom the embryos, they can have a good number of embryos that get to day three, but they never progress further. They never make it to day five. Or they're in very poor quality when they get to day five. And in that case, it's helpful not to be sort of too rigid and dogmatic and saying, okay, we're not even going to give the patient the chance, because I can tell you we've had a number of those patients who've gone on to have healthy live births because of that shift.
Well, and it makes sense in a way that embryo, the petri dish, the generic petri dish, I realize it may not actually be a petri dish, but still, you know, growing in a lab is not optimum for an embryo. So, the fallopian tube is, and the uterus is a more, well, I guess it wouldn't be the fallopian tube because you'd be putting it into the uterus, but the uterus is a more natural environment. So,
And we try very, very, very hard to make the lab environment as close to the uterus as possible, but we know for a fact that we can't be that good. The air in our lab, for example, is 1,000 times cleaner than the air you're breathing regularly. But the blood does an even better job of cleaning it. So, you know, we try relentlessly to make the conditions as optimal as possible, but, you know, it's hard to beat what's natural. And so I think that's why even when it comes to the transfer, we're doing more and more natural cycles for the transfer. So we're not medicating. We're trying to keep things that are working normally as normal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the things that you would consider for somebody who has either, and you're putting them together. You're saying implantation failure, IVF failure, or recurrent pregnancy loss. You start looking for alternative factors at that point, day of transfer.
Yeah. So I group them together in that the approach is similar of systematically studying all the things that need to go right. The list of what things you're looking for, though, are very, very different. So the evaluation for someone who's having recurrent implantation failure will be very, very different from someone who's having recurrent pregnancy loss. But the approach, the conceptual framework of trying to rigorously and carefully study what could be going wrong, that's the same.
Okay, yeah, that makes very good sense. All right, so now we'll separate them again. Let's talk about IVF failure. So you're looking at something structurally with the uterus. You're going to look and you want the best lab possible because lab factors may be subtle, but they absolutely can influence success. You would look at how the embryos are doing at day 3 versus day 5 and see if that's a possibility. What other things would you consider at that point for someone who has? And first of all, let me stop for one moment and say, when do you consider abnormal? What is abnormal from the standpoint of IVF failure? If somebody's had one, went through one cycle, fresh cycle, is that considered? And they weren't able to achieve a pregnancy, would you consider that something to be concerned about? Or how often do you have to fail before it becomes a problem?
Well, we're certainly concerned, you know, from the get-go. And even one implantation failure, we will very carefully, evaluate the entire cycle, the timing of the transfer, how the embryos looked, all the conditions to see if there was any obvious factor that could help indicate why that cycle was not successful.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of sort of going to the next level, it would probably be after two implantation failures, we start to sort of take it, you know, sort of to the next level to say, okay, maybe we're actually looking at recurrent implantation failure and there's something else going on. The reason simply being we know that, you know, for one embryo being transferred that's chromosomally normal, you'll have, let's say, about a 60% implantation rate. That means 40% of the time you won't, right, even if there's not something obviously wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so before we'd subject a patient to sort of the really much more in-depth testing, we'd want to make sure that there's not something more obvious wrong, or that was just happened to have been on that 60-40 split, they came on the wrong side.
And talk a little further about the window of implantation and what we can do now if the concern is that perhaps for some reason that the timing was not optimum for the transfer.
So there is testing that's available where you do a biopsy at the same time that you normally would be doing the transfer. And you look at the biopsy sample to see sort of a panel of genes to see if it looks like the lining is appropriate. And if it's not appropriate, whether it's a day early, a day late, and you sort of adjust the transfer based on that. That's an area of really, really interesting ongoing research. There has not yet been the sort of standard trial that you would need where they sort of take patients, give everyone a biopsy, act on the results of one and not the other and see if you're improving the outcome. So that study hasn't been done, but that's the area of, that's one of the sort of hot areas of research right now.
Yeah. Well, and the movement towards freeze all cycles, which let me stop and ask you to explain what I mean when I say freeze all cycles and the movement towards that and how that impacts that window of implantation. So, yeah, first define what I meant by freeze all.
Okay. Yeah, freeze all, I could see how that, just hearing those terms can sound confusing. Freeze all refers to freezing all the embryos that are produced, and that's as opposed to taking the and produced in an IVF cycle, and that's in contrast to taking one of the embryos and transferring them back to the uterus. So traditionally, the way IVF was done was starting around cycle day 2 or 3 of a woman's cycle, she would take medication, make a lot of eggs, do a procedure to retrieve the eggs, fertilize them, and then 5 or 6 days later, transfer 1 or 2 back into the uterus. So within that menstrual cycle, you've stimulated the eggs, retrieved the eggs, fertilized, and put an embryo or more back into the uterus. Freeze-all splits the timing of the cycle up. So in 1 month, you produce the eggs, retrieve the eggs, and fertilize them, grow the embryos till typically day 5, and then freeze them. And then the following month, at the same time in the menstrual cycle where the embryo would normally be arriving in the uterus, the embryo is transferred into the uterus. So it splits a cycle up into 2. So the question is, well, why would you do that? It seems like it just takes longer. So there's a couple reasons. The first was a practical one, which is when they wanted to do the genetic testing on the embryos, to do that, it takes time to do the testing. So by definition, the embryos had to be frozen. But the more interesting one is reason for doing these, what we're calling a freeze-all, is that in an IVF cycle, hormone levels are very different from what they would be naturally. So in a normal menstrual cycle, estrogen levels will go up to, let's say, 300 picograms per milliliter. In an IVF cycle, they could be 10 times higher, which means the uterus, which is responding to that estrogen, is seeing 10 times the amount of stimulation as normal. People have said, well, if the reason a woman wasn't getting pregnant in the past was, for example, her fallopian tubes were blocked, then her uterus was functioning totally normally. We should just try and keep the lining as natural as possible. And that's what we're doing. In most of the freeze-all cycles, when we have the chance to put the embryo back in, you could do a medicated cycle where you try to mimic a natural cycle, or you could just do a natural cycle where you just let the woman's body regulate her cycle on its own. And that's what we're moving more and more towards, with the basic thinking that for most things in reproductive medicine, there's normal and abnormal, but not a better than normal. So if a woman is producing a healthy, natural lining on her own, rather than using drugs to try to mimic the natural, you know, rise and fall of hormones, just let her body do it on its own. Instead of sort of telling her body when it's ready for the embryo, listen to the body and transfer the embryo when she's ready. So the freeze-alls allow us the ability to transfer the embryo into a much more physiologically normal environment, either by just doing a more gentle stimulation with medications or doing a natural cycle where you don't medicate at all.
And to me, that makes such good sense. And again, but also only because our technology has, our freezing technology has now made it such that the success, we're not losing embryos during the thaw, so
right.
We can now support that. You know, otherwise, back in the day, that wasn't necessarily the case. So it wasn't worth it at that point.
Yeah, I sometimes reflect. And that's a great point. I sometimes reflect on the fact that it's the advancement of technology in terms of embryo freezing that has allowed us to revert to natural cycles.
I know, it is fascinating to me. That's such a good way to put it, and yet, you know, Mother Nature has been doing this forever, so it's hard to argue that just in theory that's not the better way. You know, the more we can do that would mimic, or even not in this case, not
right.
mimicking, allowing it
Well, and the way you phrase it is perfect, by the way. And I always, in patients often comment on that, you're sort of saying, like, rather than using drugs to try to mimic what's happening naturally, just use what's happening naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so it makes intuitive sense as well as practical sense. Well, Dr. Zev Williams, thank you so much for talking with us today. This has been fascinating and very educational.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. And keep in mind that this information is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. To get more information about Dr. Zev Williams, you can go to their website. And Dr. Williams, I believe the website is columbiaobgyn.org. Is that how to get to you?
Easiest way would probably be columbiafertility.org.
Okay, I didn't see that. Columbiafertility.org. I apologize. Let's say it again. Columbiafertility.org. That's the easiest way to get specific information about Dr. Zev Williams, and we certainly appreciate your presence.
My pleasure.
Thank you, everyone, and we will see you next week.
Napa Know-How. This month, get a 5-quart jug of Napa Full Synthetic Motor Oil plus a Napa Platinum Oil Filter for $21.98. That's a pretty unbelievable deal. But trust us, it's totally real, but only for a limited time. So get Napa Full Synthetic and a Napa Platinum Oil Filter for $21.98 today. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know-How.
Napa Know-How.
General States pricing. Sales prices do not include applicable state, local taxes, or recycling fees. Offer ends 4/30/19.
The all-new Toyota RAV4 asks, what if? What if your ride was refined and rugged at the same time? Introducing the all-new RAV4 Hybrid. 208 combined horsepower and standard all-wheel drive make it the most powerful RAV4. Plus, with its head-turning style and breakaway speed, it's bound to change the way you think of a hybrid. The all-new RAV4 Hybrid. Toyota. Let's go places. Horsepower. Ratings achieved using the required premium unleaded gasoline with an octane rating of 91 or higher. Premium fuel is not used. Performance will decrease.